This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Peter Norton joins us in studio. He's a historian with the Department of Science, Technology, and Society in the School of Engineering and Applied Science. Welcome, Peter.
Welcome. Thank you.
Glad you could be here. That's quite a mouthful. Science, technology, and society. Basically, you teach the history of science to budding scientists. Is that right?
That's a nice way to put it. The title is long, but what I try to do is help engineers learn from the past of engineering because, you know, we can learn from our mistakes, but you have to know what your mistakes were before you can learn from them. And we learn from the success stories, too.
Give us a little Peter Norton 101, how you came to be. Were you one of those kids that knew very early that what you wanted to do, or was this a college discovery?
Well, I always liked history ever since I was a small child. I also always liked technology. I thought that was a separate interest, and what I found at my current job was that I could bring them together in a way that helped engineering students see the significance of what they were about to set out to do.
And your specialty is what? Do you have a particular specialty that you look at as a historian history of science?
I'm a historian of technology, so I'm looking at science in action in the world and not so much laboratory science. And within that, I have a lot of particular interests. One of them is how it happened that the automobile came to be the dominant form of transportation in American cities, even where it's not such a great fit because of the amount of space it takes up and so on.
Of course, you've got a recent article in the Journal of Technology and Culture titled Street Rivals, Jaywalking and the Invention of the Motor Age Street, which we want to talk about today. You're also at work on a book titled Fighting Traffic, which is this whole history of the rise and dominance of the car culture, I guess, in America.
Yeah, you could call it that. And was motivated in part because when I tried to find the answers to my questions, I wasn't convinced, and so I went and looked for myself, and it seemed to me the answers were actually quite different.
Well, share some of those questions that took you into the archives, and then some of the answers that you came out with.
Yeah, well, what I began with looking at what other historians had to say was, well, okay, the city was rebuilt for cars, so the people responsible were traffic engineers, or sometimes big car companies were alleged to be the main cause. Another whole angle of thought on this was that, well, look, Americans just like cars. They have a love affair with the automobile, so they bought a lot of them. And once they bought a lot of them, cities had to be rebuilt for them. Now, when I looked at it, I just started seeing totally different answers. And I think partly it's because I started looking earlier. You know, I started looking at about 100 years ago, and it was a totally different picture then.
It's interesting you say that because I had a conversation today with somebody and we were talking about, the fact that Charlottesville is in conversations to bring back its streetcar line, the trolley, which was very popular in Charlottesville for a long time, beginning in there was a mule-drawn trolley line in the 1870s, so the electric line in the 1880s. And we were talking about how, in my belief, that the car companies had a lot to do with buying up those streetcar lines in cities around the country and closing them down, which forced people to buy their cars. And my friend said, no, that didn't happen. People just wanted to buy cars, and they got sick of the trolley line. So what is the real story?
Well, you and your friend hit on the two big schools of thought on this, and I think there's truth to both of them. Yeah, Americans bought cars usually as soon as they could afford them, and, you know, cities had to accommodate that to some extent. And on the other hand, it's true that a lot of streetcar companies were bought up. The most famous case being in Los Angeles, where they were bought up by a holding company that was owned by General Motors, Firestone, and Standard Oil. And they bought the streetcar lines and ripped up the lines and substituted GM buses that burned Standard Oil fuel and ran on Firestone tires. And yes, this is true. And actually, I think both of you guys are right. It's not like it's a contradiction. But there's something missing. And what's missing is, for one thing, by the time these streetcar companies were bought up by General Motors and so on, they were already in big trouble, and most of them were bought up as bankrupt companies. And so it seems to me the problem must have been happening earlier. And by earlier, I mean mostly in the 20s is when this was really changing. And
Which is surprising because the 20s was a boom. I mean, for most of the country, businesses did very well.
Oh, yeah. And the streetcar companies were doing pretty well for the early part of the decade as well. But you know what's missing in that prosperity story? One element that's missing is that at the height of that prosperity, when the economy was just soaring, suddenly Americans were buying fewer cars. This happened in 1923 and 1924. It shocked Detroit. They met together to discuss what was going wrong here. One of their answers, they had several answers, but the one that's important here is that people in cities weren't buying cars because people didn't think of cities as a place where you could get around in a car. And they decided we're going to have to change that.
And you mean the car companies and the oil companies decided they were going to change that?
Yeah, and in this case, it's mostly automobile manufacturers and also auto clubs. The American Automobile Association was right at the forefront of this, and also local auto clubs and auto dealers in cities.
So it's interesting that we're not talking about streetcar lines that were doing very, very well. Some of them were doing poorly and went bankrupt. And clarify a little bit.
The streetcar companies and the automobile companies in some ways were completely in agreement in the 20s that they had to do something about another problem that historians have ignored, and that's the pedestrian. Because if we could see streets the way people saw them 100 years ago, we would see something totally different. We would see, well, put it this way. Today we look at a city street, we think of a motor thoroughfare, a place for cars.
Where walking is secondary.
Yeah, or where if you're going to walk, you're going to have to be very careful and yield to automobiles. Even at crosswalks, people won't enter them until there are no cars. Because people deep down think of the street as a place just for cars. And we've learned that since we were small children from our parents and in school and so on. So we, as pedestrians, have completely conceded streets to cars. And this makes it really hard for us to see a street the way people saw a street 100 years ago. 100 years ago, people looked at a street, they saw something a lot closer to what we would see when we look at a city park. It's a place for anybody to do anything, provided they don't make a nuisance out of themselves or endanger other people.
And the first thing that comes to my mind is like kids playing in the Bronx or in cities where it's still that way, where they're out playing stickball and the street is the playground.
You've got it. The street was the playground for most city kids. Still is in some places, but, you know, the change is overwhelming. It used to be that a responsible parent could tell her children, oh, go play in the street. And it wasn't, you know, a joke. It was, right. It was a serious, it was good advice, you know. And kids would go and do that. And what happened is when you had cars entering streets and parents were still doing that, you had unbelievable catastrophe. Just between 1920 and 1930, over 200,000 Americans were killed by cars. And what was totally different then is that most of those people, about two-thirds of them were pedestrians, and about half of those were kids.
Oh, my gosh. I had no idea. What are the years again?
Between 1920 and 1930.
Wow. That is amazing. Because now it's like everybody usually dies in a car accident. They're all in cars. It's cars
totally
hitting each other.
It's a different picture. And it has big significance because it means also that people could think of cars as evil. You know, if you didn't own a car and suddenly cars are taking over your city and killing your neighbor's children and endangering you, it's a lot easier to place blame on the car. Today, if people get killed in a car crash, they were probably in a car. So we don't think of the car as the evil factor. Then the anger toward cars and cities was overwhelming, and the letters to the editor of city newspapers are loaded with very angry denunciations of cars, and the cartoons and the editorial page showed cars as devils with horns and running over kids and so on.
My guest is historian Peter Norton of the University of Virginia. He's at work on a new book, Fighting Traffic, and he has a recent article about the history of jaywalking, which I guess it's an appropriate place at this point in the conversation to talk about the article, because we're literally talking about a clash between an old way of getting around, the old interpretation of what a street is, and the growing new interpretation in the 20s of what a street is for as more and more cars started coming down those streets.
Yeah, I wrote the article because I wanted to find a short way to say what I said at great length in the book. And so I wanted to pick one thing that helped change the street. And that one thing that I chose was jaywalking, because jaywalking, what people don't realize is that was really an invention. It was an invention to help redefine the street. away from being a public space for anybody and anything into being a motor thoroughfare. Because if you call somebody a jaywalker, it's saying, you know, you're a fool. The word jay means uneducated country fool. And so to combine that with walker means, okay, you are an idiotic, foolish walker. And what's interesting is that this word was being directed against people who were using the street for what it had always been used for millennia.
Well, so give us some more background on this. This is fascinating. The jaywalking was invented to help overcome this demonizing of car culture.
Exactly.
And so that cars would win in the end and own the streets.
The word was invented to help make pedestrians using the streets the way they had always used them seem like people who were using them in an illegitimate way. And it was actually, like you said, a sort of counterattack against the accusation that the car was evil and against words, similar words directed against drivers. A slightly older word is joyrider. And a joyrider was any motorist who expected pedestrians to get out of his way.
I'm thinking of, you know, when you see old footage of cities from the turn of the century and the teens, the streets are just jammed with cars and horses and people going every which way. I mean, you know, it's amazing. You really don't see that today until the lights turn red. And then all of a sudden people cross, but it's very orderly and it's only in the lines. Cars have definitely won. Where did we see this jaywalking, maybe the first laws or where this was first created?
Well, I'm interested that you consider the significance of laws right away, because wherever they tried laws alone, they were a complete disaster. They had an anti-jaywalking ordinance in Kansas City, Missouri, around 1920, and they had to repeal it because in one case, women who were stopped for jaywalking started to beat the police with their parasols. And you had similar resistance everywhere else. There was a 1921 case where a female janitor, what the newspaper called a janitress in Joliet, Illinois, was walking in the street and a car struck her and she was on the pavement. We would consider her totally at fault today, but the judge struck down the city anti-jaywalking ordinance saying no city has any business banning a legitimate use of the street by a pedestrian. So, it wasn't, in my view, it wasn't so much laws that changed practice. They needed something else. They needed to make people feel ashamed to walk in streets. They needed to draw attention to them. And there were a few techniques that worked really well. One was auto clubs and auto dealers in cities would get Boy Scouts to serve as free labor to hand out cards to pedestrians. And the card would say, "Did you know you were jaywalking?" to a pedestrian who was crossing the street in the old-fashioned way. And it was meant to attract unwanted attention to the pedestrian. Another thing that was done was clowns dressed up and were deliberately struck by Model Ts that were serving the purpose of making a demonstration out of the clown. And the point was, you're as ridiculous as this clown if you jaywalk. In Los Angeles, they combined laws, they combined laws with ridicule. The Auto Club of Southern California lobbied for a law in the city to ban jaywalking, and they were very careful and very smart. They said, don't arrest jaywalkers. Instead, the cop should blow his whistle at the jaywalker, say some kind of loud reprimand to the jaywalker, and then the jaywalker will be forced to go back to the curb where people will be laughing at them. And this was the goal of that jaywalking campaign. I think the most interesting and most important jaywalking promotional technique was perfected in Detroit by the auto industry, who said, our enemy today is public relations. The newspapers are all covering auto fatalities like it's always the car's fault. People hate cars. They're demonizing cars. We have to change press coverage. How are we going to do that? So what they did is, they sent out blank forms to every big city newspaper in the country to fill in their accident data. And they said, send it back to us and we'll return to you a report saying what your data means. And so the newspapers send back their blanks to Detroit. They were all quite happy to get a free summary of their city's accident picture from Detroit. And then Detroit would send back a report blaming jaywalkers for every accident. And there was a judge in New York City who said, this is strange. All of a sudden, every accident in the city in which a pedestrian's involved is blamed on jaywalkers in the newspapers. Last year, that wasn't that way at all. How did that happen? And that's the answer.
So they literally shamed people to staying on the sidewalk.
Yeah, and the newspaper coverage helped redirect blame at the pedestrian, too.
Did we see the numbers go down? I mean, did they help keep kids out of the... Did that help keep kids out of the street and the fatalities of kids that were being killed? Did that go down?
What really protected the kids was something else. It was school safety education, which was invented essentially by AAA in the 1920s. They came up with elaborate, glossy safety curricula with free posters and sent it to all the public schools of the country. And if you look at the posters, they show smiling children obeying the rules and not going into streets. And that was a radical change from the informal safety publicity of a few years earlier, which showed the demon cars with the horns and the injured children and the grieving parents.
All of this ultimately to benefit the automobile and oil industries, who were trying to figure out a way to get into the heads of Americans and sort of massage them so that they would stay out of the car's way and get in a car or stay on the sidewalk.
Yeah. Now, you bring in the oil companies, and actually they had a difference of view with the automobile makers on this. The automobile makers wanted gasoline taxes to be levied so that there would be money to build roads and highways. And this really upset the oil companies. And so this was not a lockstep, group of conspirators. There was some internal dissent there.
Peter Norton, historian at the University of Virginia in the School of Engineering and Applied Science. He's at work on a new book, Fighting Traffic. I'll tell you, I can't wait for the book, and I can't wait for the documentary about the book.
Well, thank you,
on the History
Coy.
Channel. That's going to be great. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure, Coy.
This interview will be archived in its entirety on the Charlotte Hill Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com and at wina.com.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.